The third condition was what? Dhabt, which is precision in memory. Right? Now here we have to go into some detail. People are at various levels of memory. Some of them have excellent memories. They will remember what you say precisely, almost word for word. Others, they will remember what you say, but not as precisely. But they're still, they have good memories. So the ulama differentiated between this. And they said, if a person has superb memory, the hadith will be considered sahih. If he has above average memory, still it's good enough, his hadith will be considered hasan. This is the only difference between the sahih and hasan hadith. Both of them are acceptable in Islamic aqidah, Islamic law, Islamic everything. Both of them are acceptable, but just to show you the precision with which the sciences of hadith were preserved, they even differentiated between someone that was well known for his dhabt and someone that was not as well known. So for example, Al-Bukhari, without a doubt, he cannot be compared to any narrator of hadith who might have adala. You must differentiate between the two. So Al-Bukhari would have been given the status of, for example, his hadith are sahih. His teacher Yahya ibn Ma'in, Ali al-Madini. Such people, they are famous and well known. That if they narrated a hadith, it would be considered of this level. And an average person, like a student of knowledge of his time, who was integral, yani he had integrity, he had a good memory, but he wasn't as famous or as well known, his hadith is hasan. But for practical purposes, the two can be used for our level, at this level, synonymously. In the sense that both of them are acceptable in Islamic everything, law, aqidah, fiqh, everything. Suppose now his memory was weak though. In other words, you could not trust him with regards to what he heard and then narrated. He heard something, then he narrated something else. But he's not a liar. In this case, the hadith becomes da'if here. Once again, da'if is a general term. There is no specific term for this. But you can say that it is da'if because his dhabt is not good. It is da'if because so and so, his dhabt did not meet the level that was required of him. Okay? And if his memory is very, very bad, then obviously it becomes very, very weak. Da'if jiddan. So depending on how bad his memory is, da'if jiddan. So over here in dhabt, you can see that sahih and hasan, this is the only difference between the two. If a person has a weak memory, it'll be classified as da'if. If he has a very weak memory, okay, it'll be classified as da'if jiddan. But a person with a bad memory never reaches a level of mawdu' or fabricated. Okay, because we didn't know that he's a liar. Mawdu' only occurs when you know for a fact this person is a liar. If a person is honest but he has a bad memory, then you say the hadith is da'if or da'if jiddan. You cannot classify it with batil or mawdu' or something of that nature. Okay. The fourth condition of sahih was what? No shudud, right? So over here, basically if a hadith is da'if because of this reason, it is called shad. The condition is no shudud. If it is, then the hadith is called, the hadith is shadh, in the sense that it contradicts something that is more authentic than it. Let me give you an example here. It is narrated in the Muwatta of Imam Malik that the Prophet ﷺ said, when one of you prays two rak'ahs of Fajr, let him lie down on his right hand side, on his right side of the body. Okay? Now, when we look at this hadith, the isnad of it, it would be at least hasan. Yani the narrators are all acceptable, truthful, everything. But when we look at the other ahadith found in Bukhari and Muslim and so many other works, we find that in fact this was not a statement of the Prophet ﷺ, this was an action reported by Aisha. Aisha said that the Prophet ﷺ, after he prayed two rak'ahs, would lie down on his right hand side. So one of the narrators accidentally, in the sense his memory once yani occasionally failed him, he made it into what? A statement that the Prophet ﷺ said, when one of you prays two rak'ahs of Fajr, let him lie down on the right hand side. How did we know this? Because when we compared all of the other chains, we compile all of the other hadith, we found that this particular person, and we know who it is, this shows you the precision with which we know the sciences of hadith, this person who was hasan level, he made this into a statement, whereas in fact all of the other people that narrated it, and they were of the sahih level, they narrated it as an action. So then we classify this hadith to be shadh. We give it a special category of da'if. We don't just call it da'if like that, even though shadh is a type of da'if. But because of the fact that all of the people in the chain are good people, are worthy, respectable people, we say it is shadh. Okay, so the hadith that it doesn't meet this criterion, it falls under shadh. The last category, which is the most complicated category, is that there can be no illas. Now, just by the term, I'm sure you realize this is more complicated than it looks. No hidden defects. What is a hidden defect? Well, the scholars of hadith have classified 10, 15, 20 different types of hidden defects, which is really beyond the scope of this class. But let me give you an example of what happened, for example, one time, which shows you what an illa is. Basically, an illa means a student of knowledge would look at this hadith with the isnad, and he would think everything is clear and fine. But only the alim, when he compiles all of the other hadith from this person and from concerning this topic, he will be able to see a defect which will not be seen by the student of knowledge. It is obviously only for the ulama. This is where you separate the alim from the student of knowledge. A student of knowledge might study hadith 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 years. He won't be able to make this particular branch his speciality. Only the major ulama, like Imam Bukhari, like Ali al-Madini, like Imam Muslim, they were able to master these ilal, and they were able to point out the hidden defects. Let me give you an example. What happened once, and again this shows you the precision with which the sunnah was preserved, that one of the students of hadith, he wrote his notes with his sheikh, and he walked out of the classroom, okay? And the wind blew, so his notes were mixed up. So what happened was, two pages, when he put them together, they were reversed over. So the isnad of one hadith went on to the matan of another hadith. Everything looks as clear as the day. But Imam Bukhari was able to point out to Imam Muslim and or other people of his time that this person made a mistake here. Because this hadith has never been narrated by this isnad, yet he narrated it. How did he know this? Because of this thing called yani hidden ilal, hidden defects. That two pages were basically swapped around accidentally. So the isnad of one hadith got connected to the isnad or the matan of another hadith. And Imam Bukhari said, this person never narrated this hadith from this isnad, rather he narrated this hadith from this isnad. So what must have happened was, the two hadith got mixed up. And in fact, in reality, the amazing thing is the scholars of hadith recorded this incident. That this student, he got his notebook mixed up, so that he would narrate hadith and he would transform them one isnad to another matan and one matan to another isnad. So the scholars of hadith mentioned this, and Imam Bukhari was able to pinpoint exactly in one hadith where it occurred. The point is, this is a very complex, complicated field, not something that is easy to explain or describe. Because of the fact we say it's a hidden defect, leave it at that, an open thing. Anything could be a hidden defect. How do we find out what is a hidden defect? The ulama, they compile all of the hadith narrated by this person and in this chapter, and then they compare it, and they're able to deduct and determine when there is a hidden defect. And again, there are different types of terms depending on what the defect is. You have maqlub, you have muttarib, many types of ilal that the scholars of hadith have defined. Tayyib. There's one more type of, there's two more type of definitions that are important. They're not related to necessarily the authenticity of the hadith, but you will read about them a lot. Mutawatir versus ahad. All of the Prophet's hadith can be categorized as either mutawatir or ahad. Okay? Now, this has nothing to do with what we just talked about. A had hadith could be sahih and a mutawatir hadith could be sahih. Okay? What is the difference between the two? Mutawatir means that it has been narrated by a large number of people in every generation. It is beyond a shadow of a doubt something that the Prophet ﷺ said. Whereas ahad hadith is something that has not been narrated in this number, in this fashion. Now, why do we care so much about this? In reality, the fact of the matter is that the scholars of the past did not care that much about it. They did not care that much about it, because any hadith that comes from the Prophet ﷺ is a hadith. However, what happened was, the scholars of innovation, they came and they tried to destroy the sunnah by another method and another manner. And they said that, well, let us differentiate the hadith between mutawatir and ahad, then we will reject the ahad and take only the mutawatir. And by doing so, they basically rejected the sunnah. Why? Because most of the sunnah is in ahad hadith. So we find that the Mu'tazila, for example, they say we will not accept ahad hadith. But now the problem arises when you reject ahad hadith, you reject most of your fiqh also. So the Mu'tazila said, okay, we'll not accept ahad hadith in matters of aqidah only. But we will accept in matters of fiqh, which is a contradiction. And to this day, this ideology is present and rampant amongst many Muslim groups. We don't want to mention any names here, but a very large and famous group in our times that denied Ahad Hadith. Sunni Muslim group. They say we will not accept Ahad Hadith. They claim themselves Sunni. I mean, they're not Sunni by saying this. We will not accept Ahad Hadith in Aqidah. To this day, this type of ideology remains. So I just want to point out that yes, there is a difference in that mutawatir has been narrated by a large number of people, ahad has not been narrated by a large number of people, but for practical purposes, every sahih hadith needs to be acted upon or believed in. There is no practical benefit for dividing the hadith into mutawatir and ahad, yet the scholars have done it just for the sake of knowledge, and the scholars of bid'ah have done it for the sake of destroying the sunnah. So keep this in mind. You will hear this phrase a lot, by the way, that ahad hadith cannot be used. Ahad hadith are not a source of knowledge. Ahad hadith cannot be relied upon totally. And all of this is from the Mu'tazila that has affected the groups of our times. So whenever you hear this, realize that this is not the position of Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah. In fact, Imam al-Shafi'i rahimahullah has a whole few chapters in his Ar-Risala about this concept here, where he defends that ahad hadith need to be used. So Imam al-Bukhari, in his Jami' al-Sahih, he has a whole kitab, a whole chapter dedicated to showing you that ahad hadith can be used. And he entitles it, Kitabu Akhbar al-Ahad, that the hadith of ahad. So all of these scholars of the Sunnah, they used to refute the scholars of the Bid'ah when they said this. Unfortunately, in our times, those that claim to follow Bukhari and Muslim, they haven't read Bukhari and Muslim, therefore they try to deny a hadith ahad. Another important category that we have to talk about is, Where is this hadith ending? For example, who said it? Did the Prophet ﷺ say it? Or did the Sahaba say it? Or did the Tabi'un say it? And depending on where it ends, the scholars have given names for each of these things. So the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ that goes directly up to him. In other words, the Sahabi says, the Prophet ﷺ said, this is called a marfu' hadith. It is raised. Marfu', it was raised all the way to the Prophet ﷺ. The meaning of marfu' is that the phrase qala Rasulullah ﷺ occurs. If the Prophet ﷺ said, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, then it becomes a hadith, what? Qudsi. Okay? So if the Prophet ﷺ says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, it becomes hadith Qudsi. If the Sahaba said that, whatever he said, like Abu Bakr said something, Umar said something, you don't call it a hadith, but you call it mawquf. This is a mawquf statement. Mawquf means it's been stopped. Stopped right before the Prophet ﷺ. Now the mawquf statements of the Sahaba, they occupy a position in our religion in that we benefit from them. And we look up to them. And we respect those statements of the Sahaba. But they don't have the same legal weight as the Sunnah. Suppose the Tabi'i made the statement, one generation under the Sahaba. We call that thing maqtur. Maqtur. Maqtur means cut off. So the hadith, it's as if it has been cut off. The first two generations have been cut off. And the statements of the Tabi'in also are important in our religion, but under that of the Sahaba, and both of these are under that of the marfu' and the hadith Qudsi of the Prophet ﷺ. So before we conclude, I want you to talk a little bit about the science of Rijal, science of men. The science of men doesn't mean we study men, we study the biographies of men, the hadith, the people, the men who narrated the hadith. This is really a very long and large science, but it was one of the earliest sciences ever in the Muslim Ummah. Because even before Bukhari and Muslim and others wrote their books of Sahih, people had already started compiling books of Rijal, or men. What is the books of Rijal? The books of Rijal basically are books related to discussing the biographies of the narrators of Hadith. So we have books written about other people. You look up the Isnad, the names that we mentioned here, there are books that you can go back to that talk about these people. Now this is something, like I said, is unique to the Muslim Ummah. It does not exist so much detailed information about three generations of Islam, the Sahaba, the Tabi'un, the Tabi' Tabi'un, and even the generations after them, one or two. Any scholar of that period, we have books written about him. You can look him up alphabetically, his name, his father's name, look him up, what the scholar said about him, how reliable he was, the other ulama that tested him, what level of precision he has. All of this has been recorded, and this is something that is difficult to conceive. And I wish we had some of the books here, I will show it to you. Only when you read these books do you realize and appreciate how this religion has been preserved. Because had it not been for this science of men, ilmul rijal, the hadith would not be preserved. every single narrator found in every single book of hadith, there is at least his name is mentioned in these books. And in some rare cases, like we said, there will be majhul, that we don't have any information regarding him, but his name will be found there. That yes, this person did narrate hadith in this time frame, but we don't really have information about him. But the majority of narrators, let me just put an estimate, like maybe 90% of the narrators of hadith, of any books of hadith, you will be able to know a biographical sketch of him, when he was born, where he lived, who his shuyukh are, okay, who tested him, what did the scholars say about him, who his students were, where he narrated hadith, any problems he might have had, everything. And this is amazing. For example, in my, when I was in second year, we had a whole year-long class called The Science of Men, Jarh wa Ta'dil if you like. We studied over 90 books written by other about this science. 90 books, the entire book is just a list of names. And these names will tell you what the scholars said about him. Imam al-Bukhari, for example, has Tariq al-Kabir. This Tariq al-Kabir that Bukhari wrote, all it is a collection of names, 12,000, 9,000 names. You just look up a name and you find what Bukhari said about him. Okay. Likewise, Imam al-Nisa'i, Imam Muslim has some books. Before them, Imam Ahmad has many books his students compile off of him. And this is something you really have to see to appreciate. The fact that these men have been talked about, discussed, and when I went to third year in my college of hadith, my yearly research paper was about one man. The entire year, from the beginning to the end, right, I had to do a comprehensive research about one person. Ikrimah ibn Ammar was his name. This man, I had to go back to every one of these 80-90 works and see what the scholars said about him and try to finally decide what was the correct opinion about this guy. And I wrote on computer 40-50 pages about this guy. And he was not one of the major scholars of hadith. Ikrimah ibn Ammar, who has heard of him? Hardly anyone. You know. Yet I was able to write a 40-50 page. I'm not saying this about myself, I'm saying this about the science. That look, one man who is an average person, Ikrimah ibn Ammar, he's not one of the big guys. One of the big guys, you write PhDs about them. Right? Yahya ibn Ma'in, he has a few PhDs. Ali al-Madini, he has a few PhDs done on him. But as for these minor players, if you like, someone like me comes along and he can write 1,400 years or 1,200 years later, a 40-50 page research paper about when he was born, where he lived, where he traveled, okay, who he studied from, who his students were, what all of the ulama before him, not before him obviously, in his time and after him, said about him, whoever talked about him, what hadith he narrated, okay, all of this was done on this man. This shows you that this is, no wonder the kuffar are jealous of us about this science. And no wonder when it is so complicated and confusing that many Muslims fall into mistakes about this. Okay, I just want to mention some of the more important works and then we'll conclude at that inshallah of Jarh wa Ta'dil. Basically, the earlier works, like what happened to hadith literature, the earlier important works, right, they were absorbed into the later works. So the earlier works, although they are still existent, only the scholars and the students of knowledge go back to them. The students of knowledge of hadith, not even any student of knowledge. Only the specialized people of the people of the field, in the field of hadith, will have these 80-90 works that I talked about, that were written 100 Hijri, 200 Hijri, 300 Hijri, 400 Hijri. Every generation has 15, 20, 30, 50, 40 works to it. As for our times, the beginning student of knowledge, if you just want to study a little bit of hadith, the first book you'll buy, the two, three main books you'll buy, we'll just talk about them. So you get an idea of what's going on here. The biggest and most important of these works is Tahdhib al-Kamal. Tahdhib al-Kamal by someone called Al-Mizzi. Al-Mizzi was a very, very close friend and student and of Shaykh al-Islam ibn Taymiyyah. Okay, he was around the same time, 726 of this, around that time, he passed away. Okay, Tahdhib means condensation, a condensed version. So this book is a condensed version of Al-Kamal. Al-Kamal was written 120 years ago, okay, and I want to, something interesting that everyone should know. This book, the original Al-Kamal, who does it talk about? It talks about the narrators of all of the six books, the Kutub al-Sitta that we talked about. In fact, it was because of Al-Kamal that we have this term, the six books. Where did it come about? Who was the one that invented the term? Why do we have these six books different from the others? Because this person, not Al-Mizzi, Al-Kamal was Abdul Ghani Al-Maqdisi, okay, who wrote Al-Kamal. He did such a thorough job, such a perfect job of compiling the names of all of the people. Remember, this is not just the Sahaba. This is from the Sahaba down to Imam Bukhari. All five, six generations of all of these six books, he compiled them from the original source works. Okay, you following me here? Right? He compiled them from the original source works, and he did such a good job of it, that because of him, and because he chose these six books, the six books became the six books. That because so much benefit was in Al-Kamal of Abdul Ghani Al-Maqdisi, they said these six books, people started studying them even more, because of the simplicity of finding a person in Al-Kamal. Okay, so then Al-Mizzi came along 120 years later, and he condensed it, Tahdhib al-Kamal. Do you know how many volumes this is published in? 37. 37 volumes. Tahdhib al-Kamal fi Asma' al-Rijal. Even I don't have this work, it's too expensive. Okay, it's in print, amazing. It's in print and available. If you go to Jordan or Syria or Arabia, any country that specializes in this, it's still it's available. Okay, this is Tahdhib al-Kamal of Al-Mizzi. Obviously, 37 volumes is not something you can carry around and benefit from. So comes Al-Hafidh ibn Hajr, the Imam of the Muhaddithin, and the one that really closed the door to Ijtihad, if you like, or I shouldn't say that, but I'm saying he perfected the science of Hadith of his time, and he wrote Tahdhib, At-Tahdhib. What does that mean? Who can tell me? The condensation of the condensation. Okay? This one comes down to a reasonable 4 thick volumes in small print. Okay, this is what I have here, Tahdhib al-Tahdhib, and this is very, very comprehensive for a beginning student of knowledge, for beginning level. This book, if you have it, again, this only deals with the six works. The six works. It doesn't deal, for example, the Musnad of Imam Ahmad, or the Musnad of Al-Tayalisi, or the Musnad of Al-Darimi, or the Sunan of Sa'id ibn Mansur. You might and you might not find the guy. If that guy is found in the six works, you'll find it in here. If he's not found in the six works, you will not find it in Tahdhib al-Tahdhib. You have to go to other works, which we're not going to mention. We don't really have time for that. But even his students complained of this. They complained it's too big, Tahdhib al-Tahdhib. So comes along Ibn Hajar again in his lifetime, and he writes Taqrib al-Tahdhib. Taqrib means making something close to you. So the Tahdhib is too far away from you, so he'll make it Qareeb. He'll give you Taqrib of Tahdhib. Okay? So this is taqrib of the tahdhib of the tahdhib of the tahdhib of the kamal of the kamal of al-Mizzi. And this is a very reasonable one volume, and some have it in two volumes. It's basically every single narrator has two lines to him. Two lines, one or two max. Nothing, never more than three lines. Whereas al-Mizzi, you could literally have 10, 15 pages about one man. So Hafidh ibn Hajar then condensed this into a few paragraphs for each person. And then in this work, Taqrib al-Tahdhib, he has one line. His full name, his full kunya, when he died, and what his level is. That's it. His level meaning, is he his lump level? Is he acceptable? Is he not acceptable? Is he trustworthy? Whatever. His final verdict. Ibn Hajar's final verdict. And this is the standard thing, that the beginning step that any person goes back to for any ilm al-rijal thing. He goes back to this statement. Now we didn't get into, neither are we going to, about how the ulama decided who was acceptable. Suffice to say that that too is a science in and of itself. They would test the people, they would examine them. It is well documented. Imam Ahmad would go to a person and recite to him the hadith that he took from him, then come back after 5-10 years and ask those same hadith to see how his memory was. Okay? And other instances of this nature, so then they would document his memory, his precision. And the books of hadith are filled with such type of anecdotes and incidences that prove to you that that is a science in and of itself. And one last point, what do we do with da'if hadith? The important question. Obviously, mawdu' hadith, without a doubt. Mawdu' fabricated hadith, nothing to do with them. Da'if jiddan, very weak, also nothing to do with them. This is unanimous consensus. None of the scholars says this. Sahih and Hasan, we take them, all of them. The ikhtilaf comes with da'if hadith. What do we do? There are three opinions, quickly. The first opinion is that you accept them in general, without much conditions put. And this is the opinion of one or two scholars. It was really an unknown opinion or not really followed. The second opinion, which is the opinion of many ulama, is that you accept them but with certain conditions. With certain conditions. These conditions are, number one, that the hadith not to be very weak, just slightly weak. Number two, that the hadith be in a chapter concerning something that is not fard or wajib or haram, but is something that is encouraged. Okay, targhib and tarhib, something that is encouraged. Okay, and number three, that when you do this hadith, you don't really believe, you realize it's a da'if hadith, so you don't really believe that you're going to get the reward that is mentioned in the hadith. Okay, these are three conditions mentioned by some of the ulama, and that's their opinion. But really, the stronger opinion for our practical purposes, and the last opinion, the third opinion, is that the average layman should not touch da'if hadith. He should stay away from da'if hadith. Why? Because the layman is not qualified to put these three things into action. And that's the first reason. The second reason, which is really very important also, that we have enough sahih and hasan hadith in order that we can start acting upon if we want to, that we don't have to start scribbling over the da'if hadith. There are so many sahih and hasan hadith. Why should we get involved with the da'if ones? When we know for a fact that the Prophet ﷺ said something, why should we argue and get into facts, a gray area that we don't know for sure whether he said it or not? You want to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Trust me, there are plenty of sahih and hasan hadith that we're not doing that we could do. And a person could live his whole life doing them without getting involved with the da'if hadith. So really, for practical purposes, and this is the opinion of Shaykh Albani and many of the ulama, it is better, much and strongly encouraged, if not obligatory, for us laymen to stay away from da'if hadith, to rely upon the sahih and hasan hadith. With that, inshallah, we'll open the floor for questions. And I have one, not just this sheet, but another sheet talking about books for further reading. And there's three levels: beginning level, intermediate level, advanced level. All of them are in English. If you'd like to benefit from them, no questions. It's salah time, inshallah. Okay, subhanakallah, wa bihamdika, wa la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.